I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, as well as talk about the history of the sport. And today we're going to have part two of our interview with Boyer Coe. And like, as I said last week, this was an interview I actually did in 2015. This interview was done as part of our video series on BodybuildingLegendsShow.com, my website. So if you never had a chance to watch that video on there, we are going to put it right now on the podcast. And we had part one last week. And in part two of the interview today, we talked to Boyer about competing in the Mr. Olympia contest, which he competed in the very first time in 1976, all the way up until 1980. And then he came back and competed a few more times. But he was really in his peak in those late 70s. And I got to actually see him compete from 77 to 79. And I told Boyer this in the interview. He improved every single year. And I think he really reached his peak in 1980. So we talk about competing, about Boyer competing against Frank Zane. And then we talk in length about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which is to this day still one of the most controversial and talked about Mr. Olympias ever. And Boyer was a big part of that. He got into a big argument with Arnold backstage along with Mike Mentzer when they had the competitors meeting, so he's going to talk about that. He's also going to talk about the footage that CBS television filmed for the Mr. Olympia that year that they never aired and why they never aired it, so that's really interesting. Boyer's also going to talk about how him and Mike Mentzer and Frank Zane and Albert Beckles all boycotted the 1981 Mr. Olympia, and they tried to get other bodybuilders to boycott it too. He talks about Arthur Jones, who was the founder of Nautilus and a very eccentric person himself. He talks about the 1982 Mr. Olympia, where he came in really underweight and why that happened. And then finally, Boyer talks about the 1994 Masters Mr. Olympia, which was the very first one that was won by Robbie Robinson, and Boyer took third behind Lou Ferrigno. And he also talks in length about when he started taking steroids and how that all came about. So Boyer's always a great interview because he's got some great stories. He's very honest and open and a real gentleman. So you're going to really enjoy part two of our interview this week with Boyer Coe. All right. And before we get started, I want to mention that we are brought to you by my sponsor, which is Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who was the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Benoit, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and now they brought on board Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and speaking of Robbie Robinson, I got big news. I finally did my interview with Robbie last week. Him and Rick Valente came on. We did a Skype interview last week, so we will be playing that interview for you guys next week. So I finally talked to the legend himself, the Black Prince, Robbie Robinson. And then just yesterday, I saw a video on Dave Palumbo's RX Muscle on his YouTube channel where Dave said that Robbie is now in the hospital, and he's fighting sickle cell anemia, which I guess he's had his whole life. And so they have a GoFundMe page where they're trying to raise money for Robbie to help pay for his bills while he's in the hospital. So I'm looking at it right now as I'm doing this recording, and one of his friends brought it up. It's under Robbie Robinson Medical Support. So if you go to the GoFundMe website, I guess just type in Robbie Robinson Medical Support and it'll pop up if you wanted to make a donation. But they had a $7,000 goal and they're already at over $5,500. So that's great. People are really stepping up and helping out Robbie, which is well deserved because, of course, Robbie is one of the true legends in bodybuilding. He's inspired so many people. So I just talked to Rick Valente, and Rick said Robbie is doing good, but he does need some financial support. So hopefully people will step up, and it looks like they are. So that's really great to see. Lou Ferrigno even texted me last night, and he asked how Robbie was doing, and he wanted to know if that was true, because, of course, Lou and Robbie go way back, and all the way back to the 70s, you know, when they were both competing. In fact, I've just been reading some of these old Muscle Builder magazines that I have, and it was really cool reading about 1977, which was the year I got into bodybuilding. And that year, they thought the Mr. Olympia was going to be between either Robbie or Lou. Lou was coming back into competition after being off a year. The last time he competed before that was in 1975 when he competed against Arnold in the famous pumping iron competition that took place in South Africa. And then in 76, Lou tried to try out for the Toronto Argonauts football team. And he actually made the team, I guess. And then he tore his Achilles tendon. He got hit by someone from the side, ended up tearing his Achilles tendon. So then he was out of football, and he decided to come back into bodybuilding and moved to California in 1977. And he trained all year for the Mr. Olympia. So everybody thought it was going to be between Robbie, who was looking amazing, and Big Lou. And unfortunately, Lou got the Hulk role on TV, which was, first of all, just a made-for-TV movie. And then they did, I think, two made-for-TV movies, and they were such big hits, they decided to make it a TV series. So then, of course, Lou spent the next 7 or 8 years doing that and never went back into bodybuilding. And then Robbie was defeated by Frank Zane, who was the real dark horse, because nobody thought Frank was going to beat either Robbie or Lou. So, but it was interesting in those articles leading up to it, everybody thought it was going to be between those two guys. So anyways, I hope Robbie does better, and I hope you guys listen in next week when I finally got a chance to interview Robbie about his great career, and he is really a legend. He's one of the greatest, because we've had so many people on the show, from Chris Cormier, Lee Haney, Phil Williams, all these guys say how much Robbie inspired them when they first started bodybuilding. So I'm really looking forward to playing that for you guys next week. I did not get any emails from last week's part one interview with Boyer Coe. Maybe because it's an older interview, but I didn't really get any emails or letters about that, so I don't have anything to read. But my training is going good. I started my mass cycle. As you know, I do this MP6 workout, and I do a power cycle for 6 weeks, and then I do a mass cycle for 6 weeks. So just got done with the power cycle, and then I did my deload week, where I just do a really easy week in between the two cycles. And so now I'm starting my mass week, and everything's going great. The weights are feeling light, and I had a really good first week, so I'm looking forward to doing 6 weeks of the mass cycle. I killed my legs because I'm doing higher reps. I was doing like 10 to 12 reps on everything, so my legs were super sore for like 5 days. So my legs are really growing, though. That's the one body part I wanted to focus on more than anything this year. And I think they were only like 25 inches when I did my photo shoot. Now they're up to 25 3/4. And I'm still staying pretty lean. I'm still staying about 210 pounds. So I'll keep you guys up to date on how that's all going. But I'm really, really happy with my workouts. And I'm happy with the gains I'm making with my legs. And I want to give a quick mention to my other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. They have a new fat-burning supplement called the Magic Pill. Everyone's looking for that magic pill, right? Well, here it is. It's developed and backed by science. This is a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So if you want to order a month's supply of this new supplement, the magic pill, it's a fat loss pill and a thermogenic. It costs $39.99, and you can just call Florida Alternative Medicine directly at 813-922-8939, and they will send you out a bottle so you could try it out for yourself. So give them a call at 813-922-8939 and try out the magic pill if you're looking to get in shape. And as I mentioned last week, and I'll mention again, I am offering consultations, online consultations for training and nutrition. If you're interested in shaping up for the summer, it will be here before you know it, or just want to get shaped up right now. I'm helping quite a few people, so just go to my website, which is dadbodtoripbod.com, and that's with a 2. So it's dadbod2ripbod.com, and you can fill out a questionnaire right online, and it will be sent right to me, and then I will be able to set you guys up, anyone out there who's interested in a training or diet program, whether you're trying to get bigger, like I am right now, or you're trying to get leaner and then keep as much muscle mass as possible. So just go to dadbodtoripbod.com, and I'd be happy to help you guys out. I know the country's really going through some crazy weather right now. My parents and my family and my brother and sister, they're all out in Chicago. They had that extreme cold weather a couple weeks ago, then it warmed up, and now I think it's cold again. I think it's only like 10 degrees out there. So, and I know there's other parts of the country that are really getting some crazy weather too. So out here in Florida, though, I think winter is over. It's almost 80 degrees out here. It's like high 70s, low 80s. So it's already only February. Early February, actually. So it looks like we are ready. The winter is over. It seems like the winters get less and less every year. So out here it's summer, but in other places, summer will be coming soon. So like I said, if you guys want to get in shape, then just contact me at naturalolympia@gmail.com or just go directly to the website, which is dadbodtoripbod.com. And before we get to our interview, part two of our interview with Boyer Co., I want to also mention that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them again. Their office number is 813-922-8939. Or you can go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. flalternativemeds.com. And mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation, plus they will give you 20% off your order. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Boyer Co., which we did in 2015. This is part two of our interview. This is really a great interview. You're really going to enjoy it. Here we go.
Now, when you were competing in the Mr. Olympia in the late 1970s, when Franco won and then Frank Zane won 3 years in a row, what did you think about those competitions? Anything stand out in those? Because I remember I used to go to those shows, Boyer. I went to 77, 78, 79 when I was a teenager. And I remember when they started those Grand Prix events, you would compete in almost every show. But at the Olympia, you always hit your peak. I was always amazed at how great improvements you made every year consistently from 77, 78, 79, and 80.
You know what? That's a great mystery. I'd compete in those contests, and I would manage, I guess, to get in decent shape, but it seems like I always managed to hit it right on the money at the Mr. Olympia. I mean, it seemed like I got it all together, and, you know, that's a mystery. I don't know how I did it. It just worked out that way.
What did you think about Frank Zane when he was winning in the contest as a Mr. Olympia winner?
Well, I thought Frank was always good. He was always a professional. And Frank, like most bodybuilders, he's a thinking man's bodybuilder. He knew his body well, and he always managed to get in shape. Now, Frank was not big by any means. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't a massive bodybuilder, but he really knew how to display his physique to the absolute best. He was a master poser. Let me back up one thing. Nobody knew a damn thing about posing until Ed Koenig came on.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw Ed Koenig, I said, wow, the rest of us are so far behind. We got to catch up to this guy. And that's when I really even worked harder on my posing. And then you had guys like Zane was an excellent poser. Chris Dickerson was an excellent poser. I never ever allowed myself to think that I looked great in a contest. standing in the lineup, John, you probably wouldn't even notice it. But, and I can't explain it, because some people have it and some people don't. Okay? And that's showmanship. But I could come alive when I went through the posing routine.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really worked hard on the transitions, the motions, the smoothness and everything. That helped me out a lot. And it seemed to be something like, for example, let's use Frank Zane for example. Frank Zane looked excellent, standing relaxed. You noticed it.
Yeah, yeah.
He posed, he looked good, but he didn't look spectacular. Another example, Chris Dickerson looked magnificent, standing relaxed. But once again, when he posed, he looked good, but he didn't jump out at you. But let's take another guy, for example. Casey Viator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Casey looked okay standing in line. But when he started posing, his body just exploded.
Yeah, yeah.
You said, wow, where did all that muscle come from? And I like to think that I had some of that ability as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Seeing standing there, looks all right. But when I hit a double bicep, hell, you noticed it, you know?
Right.
And that's the way, I can't explain why some people are like that and some people are not.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I gave Frank, he always was a professional. I think he deserved his titles. He really did.
Okay. And then some people today may also not realize that back then, the only time the bodybuilders used music was when they did guest posing. But for the competitions, they really didn't have music until the late 70s. And then I think you really used that to your advantage, too, because you always pick very inspirational music. And I remember reading an article once where you said that you feel that music is an emotion and that you can get the audience
motivated. I've always loved music. I mean, and it's so emotional. I mean, to be honest with you, this may sound crazy to you, if I've never, ever got into bodybuilding, the one desire I would have had, I would have wanted to be a blues piano player.
Oh, really? Okay.
I love blues, and for some reason, all the great, best piano players came out of New Orleans. You go from Jerry Lee Lewis, to Fats Domino, to Pine Top Perkins, all of those guys came out of New Orleans. Why, I don't know. It's just like all the great blues guitarists came out of Clarksville, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. No
fear, but that's how it was.
Yeah, and then, so let's go to the 1980 Mr. Olympia now. This was the big controversial Olympia. I know you and I have talked a little bit about this by email, and now it's like 35 years later, and this is still probably the most controversial, one of the most controversial Mr. Olympias ever. Did you know that Arnold was going to compete in that show before the contest?
You know what? If I had been smart, I would have realized, but I was a dummy. I didn't. Let's back up to the first Miss Olympia contest.
Right.
It was in 1980 in Philadelphia. George Snyder put it on. Okay. So this is shortly before the Mr. Olympia. And you had myself, Frank Zane, Mike Mincer, and I think Ron Tufel, guest posts. Okay. So we're all in good shape. And that was right after Frank had his accident.
So he
was lacking, okay? Because he'd been in a hospital for about 10 days. He'd lost a lot of weight. And Arnold was there, and we had a trade show. You know, had supplement companies. I was with Body Master, so we had our equipment on display there. And I recall Arnold, it was so important for Arnold not to miss a workout, that he was down there working out in the area where we had the trade show. And he had a film crew following him around. I never paid any attention to it. So I just totally dismissed it. And then I remember George Snyder, because I did a lot of business with George Snyder. He had Olympus Health Clubs at the time, and he was franchising. We sold a ton of equipment to those guys. So I was on the phone with George almost every day. And he's saying, you know, he says, I know who's going to win the Mr. Olympia. He said, I got it written down, and I got it on a piece of paper locked in my safe. So that's good. I'm amazed that you know who's going to win. I never thought about it. But you got to remember, they had, in those days, they had a thing called an association. It was Arnold, George Snyder, Franco Colombo and Bill Drake. Okay? But I'm not, you know, maybe I'm just naive in those days. Never paid any attention.
What was the association, Bart?
Well, in other words, what they did, they formed an association where you got a discount on supplements, gym equipment, and clothes, sports clothing and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then they would get a piece of it. So, I mean, I sold a lot of equipment at a discount, and they in turn, you know, turned me on to customers. And I'm sure the supplement companies, they went down the line, did the same thing. But to answer your question, I didn't realize that Arnold was going to enter the Mr. Olympia until the night before, because Bill Pearl called me. Told me, said, I just want to let you know Arnold's going to enter the contest. I said, well, you're okay. Yeah. And then, and I know this has been discussed a million times, and people argue about it, and you're right, it's over 30 years old. I don't know why people continue to argue about it. And their opinions are very strong, but you have to have opinions like assholes. Everybody's got one.
You know?
But and most of the people that want to argue about it so energetically weren't even born in 1980. You know? But the thing is this. I remember sitting back there at the pre-judging, and Mike Vincent and I are sitting there talking, and we see Arnold, and the best way I can describe it, he looks thin. And I even remember telling, like, I said, you know, I don't know why Arnold's doing this. This is a shame. He's going to lose. You know, why would he risk his reputation? This is, everybody had high regard for him. Well, as it, you know, fast forward as it turns out, Arnold won. And everybody makes big deals about Mike and Arnold get, you know, almost having coming to blows at the prejudging meeting. The thing was, how it all got started, and I'm sure you've heard it.
Yeah.
We all agreed the year before there would be no height classes. No, it's an open contest.
Yeah, no under
200,
over
200. Yeah, and I explained that to Ben Leader, and he says, you know, you're absolutely right. We just got to have one. So we get there. Arnold says, no, we want two classes. So whatever amount of people had in the contest, maybe they said they had 17 people in the contest. So we all voted ahead of time. 16 people said, no, we wanted open. Arnold wanted two classes. So trying to be a good on that, I stood up and I said, okay, Arnold, we're going to give you the floor. Explain to us why you think it's going to be, you want two classes. What's the reason? And instead of saying, okay, well, boy, this is my reason, he says, well, why don't you talk like a man? And I'm thinking, well, hell, I'm giving you an opportunity to say something. And that's when Mike blew up. I guess he had gotten tired. He jumps in there. And it probably would have come to blows because Mike was pretty mad.
Mm-hmm.
Had Dick put a lot step between Mike and Arnold, all hell would have broke loose. And the way Arnold was sitting, and if Mike would have hit him, he would have taken Arnold's head off. Because he was right over him, and Arnold was just sitting down with his hand. But, I mean, as it turned out, everybody, I really think this, in retrospect, if Arnold had to do it over again, he wouldn't have done it, because it cost him a lot of friendships. And it definitely colored his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite as mad as the thing having an illegitimate kid with the maid, but nevertheless, you know, it put him down a much lower notch in the guys that had always held him in high regard.
What did Arnold say to Mentor to get him so mad? Where Mentor came walking over to him?
He gets off the subject. He says, "Well, everybody knows why you didn't win last year." He says, "Your gut's too big." And that's when the really got started.
Okay.
I think if I remember correctly, Mike might even cock his arm back. He was ready to punch him.
Really?
That's when Bill Pearl stepped between.
So Bill Pearl was the one that stepped in and stopped it.
Yeah, exactly. Bill Pearl was. And then after Ben Wheat saw it was safe, then he jumped in and tried to. He was very careful not to get in between Mike and Arnold right away.
So the timing was right.
Yeah, exactly.
So going through the prejudging of that show then, did you feel like Arnold, you said he wasn't at his best. Did you feel like he had a chance to win? Who did you think was going to win the show?
Well, it's interesting to, and only I can offer you an opinion.
Yeah.
I would say this. Once again, I thought Chris looked good, and a lot of, and Chris obviously came out second.
Yeah.
But I never picked Chris as the winner. I don't know why. Frank was in good shape. He had improved a lot since 2 weeks ago at the Miss Olympia, but he was still a little thin. I thought Mike was in excellent shape, and I was in excellent shape at the. I don't think anybody. I can't recall Mike or anybody else saying I should have won the Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
But everybody was in agreement that Arnold shouldn't have won.
Right.
If I would have been a judge, I would have had Arnold probably somewhere around sixth or seventh place. But I tell you, the guy who has researched that and done a meticulous job on that, if you ever want to read what really, really, really went on, is read some of Randy Roach's books.
Oh, yeah, Randy's great.
Yeah, he is the absolute best. I mean, he and I became friends just talking on the phone, you know, and I never met him, and I didn't realize the guy was blind.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
You know, why does he do this?
I know.
So there was a seminar in Cleveland, Ohio, and he was going there. I said, you know, Randy, I want to meet you. I'm going to fly to Cleveland just to meet you. And first, what a nice guy. You know? I don't particularly agree with everything he says on nutrition because he's big into raw foods.
Yeah.
He eats everything raw. I like meat rare, but I don't like it completely raw.
Right. Yeah, for those that don't know what we're talking about, Randy Roach wrote a series of books called Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, and he's written two volumes, and he's writing volume three. And I know he's actually interviewed me a little bit because I went to the 1981 Mr. Olympia and I saw that show. So he was asking me my opinions on that. But I know he's talked to you a lot and he's talked to many other people in the sport. And for those people that haven't read those books, they're really well researched and they're very big books and he's put a lot of effort into them. So I hope more people support him and read his books because they're really amazing.
Well, if anybody's got a real love, a real passion for bodybuilding, that ought to be required reading for them.
You
made a remark a little bit earlier that you talked about the 1980 Mr. Olympia being the most controversial. I respectfully disagree with you. I think 81 was probably the most controversial.
Right.
Because, as the story goes, we decided, hey, we don't want to applaud. I knew in advance. The whole year, I said, Franco was going to win the contest. And everybody said, oh, no. And even I remember saying, you know, this would have never happened if this contest would have been in America. But it went up, it shows you how wrong I was. Next year, the same thing happened again. Now, you were there.
Yeah.
I can't really comment on it. Only you can comment on that contest. But from what I understood, there was a lot of unhappy people in the audience that night.
Yeah, that was, I think, the most controversial contest I've ever seen in person. I wanted to ask you, Blair, about going back to 1980. Some people may not know this, but CBS Television was there to film the show as back then in the late 1970s, ABC Wide World of Sports was usually filming the Mr. Olympia, and then NBC and CBS got involved, and then CBS was there filming it in 1980, and then that footage was never used. And you did get to see that footage, though, didn't you?
I did. There was only four people that I recall saw that footage. This is what happened. Prior to the Mr. Olympia, CBS sent a film crew and spent 2 days with who they assumed might be the top competitors. They spent 2 days with Mike Menzer, 2 days with Dennis Tenorino, 2 days with me, and there might have been 2 days with Chris Dickerson. I'm not quite sure. So that film crew, I knew they had been to my home, spent the whole day with me, and then that same film crew went over to Sydney to film the contest. And let me think of the guy's name. I remember the guy that was there. His name will come to me in a minute. But he was there, and he called me in Sydney after the contest, and he says, I'd like to have a meeting with you and Frank and Dennis and a couple of other people. He said, you know, we're never going to be able to show this on TV. He said, it's just too controversial. So, I said, okay, that's just the way, that's the end of it.
Now, why did he say that, Blair? Why did he say it was too controversial?
Because it was obvious to him that Arnold didn't deserve to win it, and they didn't want to put something so controversial, even to the average person sitting in the audience, to realize, hey, something's wrong here. This is not right. So I never thought any more about it. So Sherm Egan, that was the guy's name. He was the guy that was producing the thing for CBS. So somehow or another, he calls me later that year because I'm in New York, and he says, if you'd like to see the uncut version, the unedited version of this thing, he says, meet me at CBS, and I'll let you watch it. So I contacted Wayne, his wife at the time, Karen, Chris Dickerson, and one of Chris's buddies. We went and watched the thing. And I didn't realize what a great difference it was until you're sitting watching the thing. And that's when it really was apparent, hey, something is wrong here. And he said, this is it. We're never going back. So even though they paid the sanction fee for 1981, they never went back. And as far as I know, they never filmed anything related to bodybuilding ever again.
So what was your opinion of the footage, Blair? What did you say when you saw it?
Well, I mean, it stuck out just as much as I had experienced. I mean, Arnold was by far not in his best shape. And as I said, two things I noticed that stood out in watching Arnold. He looked thin, okay, but he also looked unbelievably nervous. He was not confident. He's always been noted for being very, very confident in charge. He was not. Even with all the judges in his pocket, he was still unsure of how the crowd was going to react, and they did react quite negatively when they announced the results of the contest. But it didn't affect him. You know, he went on. Let's give him credit. I remember innocent Mike Visser telling me this was in 1981. He says Arnold was in the Rose Cafe, which is right down the street from Gold's, and at the time Mike's girlfriend happened to be in the Rose Cafe getting something to eat, and Arnold's telling him, he says, yeah, he says, you know, he said, those bodybuilders think that they're going to boycott the Mr. Olympia. He said, before it's all over with, he said, they're all going to be kissing my ass and they'll be in the contest. And he was right. That's why I've always said the only people that I really think had credibility then was Mike Mincer, Frank Zane, myself, and Albert Beckles. Because we stood by our decision, we weren't going to be part of it.
So were you trying to get other people to not do that show also?
Well, we had gotten together at the time, and virtually every bodybuilder that I can remember, maybe there was a couple of them that didn't sign, but we had signed an agreement. And I told Ben Mead, I said, look, we can't agree with what's happened. You know, I said, I don't want any part of this anymore. And Ben did, he probably knew bodybuilders certainly better than I did. He says, well, do whatever you gotta do. Because once again, even though with Joe and Ben, I was one of probably maybe the only bodybuilder that never, ever had a contract. Everybody else had no contract. I did tons of business with Joe and Ben, but always on the business side. And that's how we always got along. They respected me, I respected them. When they asked me to do something, I was always there. When I showed up for these promotions, I was always in shape, I did it. And never had to wonder, well, when is he going to show up? Is he late or not? I did all that.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, you know, they all may have signed it, but then immediately they said, well, if Mike is not going in, and Frank is not going in, Boris is not going in, maybe we got a chance.
Right.
I remember telling Tom Platz says, well, you know, if we don't go in, what about my career? I said, if you don't stick together with us, nobody's going to have a career.
Right.
You know,
right.
Once again, I will give Tom Platz credit. He looked awesome. That's the best he ever looked was in 1981.
Contest. How was your relationship with Mike Mincer? You guys were pretty good friends, right?
Mike Mincer, excuse me, one second.
Sure.
Mike Mincer and Frank Zane and I were good friends. And it basically kind of resulted from our common cause of the experience we had in the 1980 Mr. Olympia. I mean, I remember meeting Mike, actually, I was over in France when he lost I gave an exhibition when he lost the Mr. Universe to Cal Scala.
Yeah.
That's how he and I and Danny Padilla became good friends.
Okay.
And Danny, I would have to say, probably the most symmetrical, well-balanced bodybuilder I've ever saw. He had no weak points. It's a shame he was just a little on the short side. If that guy would have been 5'10", I don't think anybody would ever be.
Right.
He just, everything blended together perfectly. And a very nice, very humble guy as well. And a funny guy.
Yeah, he is a funny guy. And then Mike, you also had a good relationship with him?
Oh, yeah, Mike and I had a lot of good times together. Mike and I did many seminars together. We traveled all over the place doing seminars and posing exhibitions. Yeah, we got along real well. I knew his brother, but not very well. See, there was a time after all of that, we all worked for Arthur Jones, but in a totally unrelated situation. See, believe it or not, I knew Arthur Jones since I was 9 years old.
Really?
Now, I didn't, I mean, it was just by accident, because at that time, he had probably never even thought of Nautilus, but he was in importing and exporting wild animals and also flying. And he had a reptile farm in Slidell, Louisiana. So I remember driving by there on the way going to Florida, and, you know, as a 19-year-old kid, hey, Dad, let's stop. We've got to take a break.
Right. We'll go out
there and look at the, you know, he had some impressive stuff. But what people didn't realize, and I didn't get to know years later, all those reptile farms throughout the southern states was a front. It was a front for gambling. You know, a kid, I didn't realize. I just, you go in and look. But they always had a big card game going on in the back. And Arthur had a real distinct voice. So while I saw the guy, and I didn't know who he was, I remember that voice. So the first time Arthur called me was maybe a few months after I won the Miss America. I remember his first call. He says, yeah, answer the phone. He says, hey, this is Arthur Jones. He says, I got a machine down here in Florida that will build latch on a garden rig. Are you interested? Yeah. Down in the crack pot, you know? So, but anyway, you know, and the only reason that he called me, because he wanted Bill Pearl to go down there, because Pearl had been in a movie years before that Arthur made.
Right.
And man, he said, I really don't want to go all the way to Florida. He said, look, he said, there's a new kid in Louisiana, just won a Miss America, Latin Universe, why don't you call him? So Arthur called me, and so, you know, hell, I'm game, I go down there. Hell, I helped Arthur build the first prototype on the front porch of his house.
Wow.
So we worked together for maybe a month, but I couldn't get along with him. I said, I'm going home. So that was like maybe 1970. So then again, in the, oh, I guess maybe, I guess 1982, I see Arthur at an Ursa trade show, big equipment trade show. And we sit there talking, and by that time we had started Body Masters, and not anywhere close to competing with Nautilus, but we were starting to eat into some of those sales. So he says, I want you to come to work for me. So what do you want me to do, Arthur? He says, I don't know. He said, we'll think of something. So when I go down there, I am blown away. I didn't want to get involved in it, but Arthur had 100,000 square foot. Are you still there, John?
Yeah.
Okay, because I got, okay.
Yeah, anyway, just went ahead.
Yeah. He had 100,000 square foot television production studio. And I had sense enough to know, man, if I can get in on the ground floor of this, I'll be a zillionaire.
Yeah.
But at the time, he had more camera equipment than ABC, NBC, and CBS combined.
Wow.
He had
nine
functional studios that he could produce. So, you got to remember now, this is about the same era that Turner is starting CNN.
Okay.
Now, Ted Turner's got cable. Arthur doesn't have cable, but Ted doesn't have production capabilities. Arthur had unbelievable production capabilities. So we go to Atlanta, we go see Ted Turner. He says, look, he says, I'll provide you all the production you want for all your shows, and it'll cost you nothing. All I want you to do in return is run mindless commercials 24 hours a day. Because I'm looking around, he didn't have much in the way of stuff. I mean, CNN was just getting started in those days. Listen, so if that would have come about, I mean, but Ted turned it down. He was afraid of Arthur. Listen, he was afraid of Arthur. Came on too strong, so that never happened. But I really believe if Arthur would have been successful in starting his cable like he wanted, he would be as big as like Fox and CNN is today.
Wow.
He was so far advanced. Let me give you an example. 1972, I'm down there. He had called me and we had to go down and look. He was just starting to put his first pullover machine with a selectorized weight stack. Mm-hmm. Before they had plate-loaded weight stacks. I'm in there talking to him. Pete Gronkowski was down there. And he was trying to win, he was trying to go for the Mr. America. So Arthur says, you know, he says, one day, he says, there won't be any more libraries anymore. He said, there won't be any books. So what do you mean? He said, you know the Sears Roebuck catalog? He said, that'd be a thing of the past. I said, what do you mean? Arthur says, look. He says, not right now, it's too expensive. But he said, everything will be on these little discs. And they'll be just a casual purpose. Maybe $2 or $3, you'll watch it. Throw it away. Just like you buy a magazine and throw it away. Now you gotta remember, 1971-72, VHS hadn't even come out yet.
Wow.
But he already knew about the disc. Which only led me to one conclusion. Arthur, and I cannot prove this, just speculation, Arthur was involved with the CIA.
Really? Really?
Yeah, because when I worked down there, there was constantly FBI, CIA people. G. Gordon Liddy was down there all the time. Hmm. He was connected in some way. And you just don't all of a sudden go from having nothing to having more money than you know what to do with.
Right.
And not
right.
As to do fast. 1970, when Casey won, well, you know, you remember Casey was third when he won the Miss America, Dickerson won.
Right.
If Casey
right.
would have won that night, nobody would have complained. Right. He was only 18, and he was outstanding.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So that August or that September, Casey goes to New Orleans, but he was living with Arthur at the time. Goes to New Orleans, wins the USA. Well, he brings the first plate-loaded pullover machine. Red LaRue paid him $300. That's the only $300 he had. That was it. $300. And you go from that to a couple of years later, he's got helicopters, he's got jets. He's got 100,000. Where the hell did all that money come from?
Yeah, right.
I mean, equipment was selling good, but it wasn't selling that good.
Right, right.
But once again, good story, but just my speculation.
Yeah, he was a strange character, wasn't he? For those that never met him.
He was one of the most unique individuals I've ever met. Not the most unique, but one of the most unique.
Who was the most unique?
Well, I have to tell you, the most unique individual I ever met was a guy that taught me showmanship. His name was Ben Mouton. He was an old circus performer. I met him when he was maybe mid-50s. But this guy for 15 years was a top attraction for Ringling Brothers Circus.
Hmm.
And he came from Lafayette, Louisiana, and he was just an old broken circus. This guy had done everything. He worked in the movies with Rudolph Valentino. He had worked as a stuntman with Earl Flynn. He had done everything. I remember him telling the stories. One summer, and I always wanted to get somebody to write a book on this.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
But one summer, he loved to eat watermelon. So every afternoon after we finished working out, we'd go buy a watermelon. We'd sit there and eat and listen to his stories. He told me a different story about his life. Every day for 3 months, he never repeated the same story twice.
Wow.
That's it. So he was the most interesting guy I ever met by far. And he really showed me showmanship because he spent his whole life around carnivals and circuses. Much like Arthur. Arthur was as great a genius as Arthur was with equipment. Arthur was the best marketing guy I ever came across.
I almost think I'll go back to the bodybuilding after all those stories.
I didn't mean to stray off of
that. No, that was great stuff. So then you go back into bodybuilding back in 1982, and that was the year Chris won, right? And I'm sorry, we skipped 1981, because even though you didn't do the Olympia that year, you did do all the Grand Prix shows.
Yeah,
and you had a, looks like, I'm looking at muscle memory here, it looks like you got like 7 wins that year.
Honestly, John, I don't remember. Like I said, the contest to me was only like kind of like a measuring stick.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I win a contest and I think, man, I'm doing pretty good. And I get back home and the guys that I train with said, you know, you didn't look near as good as you did the last time. So they always bring me down, you know, to a realistic level. Because those were people that, I wasn't impressed. But I didn't impress them. They were just calling it like they saw. So I respected their opinion. So that's the guy that really, when one of those guys would give me a compliment, like Red, for example. Red's a great guy, but he's very, very thin on compliments. I can remember him, when he came to say, you look good, I remember it. I remember he, unwillingly, at the 1979 Mr. Olympia, he shows up. I didn't even know he was there. Somehow he manages to get backstage. And he runs into me and says, you know, he says, you might win this thing tonight. Well, hell, to me, that was as good as me winning. But he never gave me a compliment.
Right.
So that was the highlight of my, I think I might have played third, but to me, that was as good as winning. Him telling me, hey, you look pretty good.
You know, the one show I remember you did, Boyer, was really interesting, was where you guys had, like, different pose-offs. I think it was called the Canada Cup or something, and I mean, it came down to you and Chris Dickerson.
You just kept paring them down. So each one of us must have posed at least a half a dozen times.
Yeah, that was a unique concept for a contest, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was as far as... That was the only time I ever remember.
Never did it, right?
Did that, you know? That was the one and only time.
You also go ahead.
I said I remember because I remember telling those guys, trying to keep those guys together. I said, you know, Franco's going to win the 81 Olympia, and he ended up going anyway. So I didn't go, but I went over to all the Grand Prix. So I'm over in. They had a Grand Prix in Belgium, and then one in Wales, and then one in Montreal, all three within maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And I always remember Johnny Fuller saying, boy, I wish we would have listened to you. Because he said, you were right on the money in 81. Everybody got screwed again.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure, now once again, I wasn't there, but I'm sure that probably Platts and Danny Padilla and even Roy Callender must have really been upset because those guys, along with Chris, those guys were phenomenal shape that year.
Yeah, I think they were all in their best shape.
Who would you have given the contest to in 81? Who do you thought should have?
I thought Platts was going to win, and I actually thought Roy Callender would have been second. Even though Danny looked outstanding, I thought Danny looked a little small next to the other guys, you know. But by himself, he looked incredible.
Oh, yeah.
But I would have had those three.
He had the reflex, you know. He was good.
And I thought Chris was going to take fourth. I would have had Franco no higher than fifth just because he had no legs, you know.
Yeah, it was always a mystery to me, but, you know, it's what it is, you know.
Yeah.
But I will say this. I mean, there's nothing worse to me than when you win a contest and you know deep down inside you don't deserve to win.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have, even though he wouldn't admit it, he must know deep down inside, hey, I didn't deserve that.
Yeah.
To me, that was terrible.
So then in 82, then you went back into the Olympia, and that was the year that that Chris won,
right.
Chris Dickerson won. But weren't you working also with Arthur that year?
No.
Arthur Jones? No?
No. Everybody thinks that.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Everybody thinks that. And I always said, boy, you look terrible. And I did look terrible. Okay. But it had nothing to do with Arthur Jones. I didn't go back to work with Alpha Jones until January of 83.
Okay. So
what exactly happened in 82, and this is the first time I've ever had an opportunity to tell this. 82, I said, okay, I'm going to come back. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to get as lean and as muscular. I'm going to try and emulate Frank Zane. I'm going to be like that. What happened that year, the guy at the gym says, oh man, he says, I got this great diet pill. And he says, this is going to help you out. So it was called, I don't remember the pharmaceutical name, but it was called Fastin. Well, hell, it was speed, but I didn't realize. So my training partner and I started taking it. And I mean, it was just like literally, you just talk up a storm. Only slept 4 hours a night that whole year because I was running 3 businesses, working out, doing cardio, and I just felt wonderful. And it sure, it ate all the fat away, but it ate all the muscle away too.
Wow.
Okay, so that's what happened. It really, everybody said, oh, well, boy, he didn't take anything, and it just ate the muscle and everything away. Okay, so 82 is over with. I decided, okay, I'm going to get in with Arthur. I want to learn his cable television business. So I immediately stopped there. So I was so depressed for about 6 months. I couldn't figure out what. I felt like I wanted to cry all the time. Jesus, what is this? So time goes by. You know, it gets out of your system. You're wearing up. So eventually, in May of 84, Arthur and I end up having a dispute, so I leave and all this, come back to California. Immediately when I come back to California, I look up my old training partner. So one day we talk, and I said, hey, do you remember that Fastin we were taking? He said, yeah. He says, you know, he said, after I got off that stuff, he said, I was so depressed, I'd cry all the time. I said, well, that's it. That's what happened to it. I said, it was the after effect of that.
Right.
So that's what happened. You know, you get to believe, wow, I'm so cut and everything. You don't realize you ain't got any muscle left. But that's what happened. You know.
Yeah.
And so naturally, 83. Once again, I didn't do anything. I was involved with Arthur. So then 84, I felt I was done. I had no interest in bodybuilding. So I go. I'm sitting in the movie theater. I'll never forget this. And I'm watching this movie with Robert Redford called The Natural. Great movie, very inspirational. So I'm thinking, you know, that inspired me to do something. I'm going to try one more time. And I went back in 84, but once again, I made a mistake. You know, I came in too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would try to go the opposite route, and as the year that Lee Haney won, looked magnificent, and then he had a long run. That was another nice guy, Lee Haney.
Yeah, I was going to ask him what his thoughts were with Lee Haney and seeing someone new like that come up, another young guy come up and win the Olympia.
He was exceptional. He was very, very good. And once again, just like Bill Pearl, nice guy, always fame never changing, humble guy, easy to get along with. I have tremendous respect for Lee Haney.
What did you think about that contest in general, Boyer? Because that was the year that Sergio also came back.
Sergio came back. That, you know, it was an interesting thing there, and it was held in the Felt Forum in New York. Everybody, the thing was, Lee Haney was a deserving winner.
Yeah.
But everybody wanted Sergio to win.
Yeah.
I was hoping he would win.
Right.
I mean, he was past his prime, but my God, it was Sergio. It was only one.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he had, I can't say this. Some people just have natural charisma, and Sergio had.
Mm-hmm.
And by far, he certainly had the coolest clothes. Everything was tailored to a T. He dressed so much better than everybody else. And he always had all the gobs of jewelry, big gold bracelet, big medallion. He was quite a character.
Yeah, he was. I'm glad I got to meet him when I was living in Chicago.
He was one of a kind.
So then, competitively, then it wasn't until 10 years later when you went to the Masters Mr. Olympia in 1994.
That's true. Well, the fun thing about the Masters Mr. Olympia, that was a contest that was created specifically for Lou Ferrigno.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wasn't fortunate enough to win the Mr. Olympia. So He pounded and hammered Joe, you got to have a contest. So he created a Masters Mr. Olympia. But they made one mistake, okay? So it was, originally it was going to be 45 years, you had to be 45 years or old.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
It turned out he was only 42, so he couldn't compete. So, oh, man, we got to change the rules. So he changed the rules. Everybody knew that Louis was going to win.
Right.
You know, when he invited me, I said, sure, I'll compete. And he goes, I just want to see if I'm in really, really good shape one more time. Which, and I think I told you this, that was the most satisfying thing for me, because at age 48, I thought that was the best shape I'd ever been. Certainly the biggest shape I was in. I think it was 225, 228.
Wow.
And that was, and I carry a lot of definition and muscularity, you know. And Louis was good, but Robbie was better.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I mean, Louis took that extremely hard. Boy, that upset him, because he won that contest. And like I told him, I said, when we had the competitors meeting, he said, hey, he had a $25,000 prize.
Right.
So let's all get together and do this, okay? Whoever wins gets the pot, gets $25,000. Because it all costs us more time and money away from business and everything to get ready for the contest. But everybody kind of went along with it except Robbie. So Robbie immediately after the meeting runs to Joe and says, Joe, boy, he wants to give the winner of the contest all the money. That's not fair. So when the contest is over, I said, you know what? You know what you did, Robin? You just screwed yourself out of $15,000.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the winner only got 10, and the rest of the money was divided up. Well, I mean, you go for the love of the contest, not for the money.
Right, right.
I mean, maybe it's different today. The prize money is a lot bigger, so maybe that's a motivating factor. But you still, I mean, it's the same reason I get up and train. I'm in the gym at 5 o'clock every morning. You still got to have the passion for it.
Yeah,
you don't have that passion, you're never going to get anywhere.
Right.
And that's anything like.
So tell us about your training for that show then, Boyer. How did you make such improvements and compete better than ever?
Okay, well, two things. One, I changed my routine, okay, to kind of coincide with what Dory was doing, you know, high-intensity training,
mm-hmm.
but modified a little bit, and I took liberal amounts of steroids and growth hormone. That made a big difference.
Okay.
You know, that helped me out a whole lot. That made a huge difference. I mean, I will be one of the first ones. I'll never deny it. I just happened to be in the right spot at the right time. I was introduced to steroids back when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Diana Ball first came out. It was hardly anybody knew about it. And I only happened to know about it because Dr. John Ziegler, who invented it,
right.
was friends with Alvin Roy. Alvin Roy was one of the coaches that set up the Olympic teams when they went to Europe. When he found out, when Dr. Ziegler talked to the Russians and whoever, found out what they were using, he came back, got Seabrook to develop Dianabol. Okay, you're probably too young, you don't remember this, but Hoffman was promoting isometrics. Do you remember isometrics?
I remember isometrics. I didn't know Hoffman was promoting that.
Okay, Hoffman was the one that promoted isometrics. Straining against an immovable ball, and everybody was getting so strong.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man, these guys were just breaking world records. It wasn't because of isometrics. It was because of Dianabol. One of the guys who held a world record at the time was Lou Rickey from New Orleans. He had a 300-pound or more than 300-pound snatch. In 181-pound class. It was in the blue pills. It was a Dianabol.
Right.
Also, Alvin Roy, back in the late 50s, was coaching the LSU football team. LSU was killing everybody. They won the national championship several times. Why? Well, first of all, they were weight trained. First weight trained football team in the country, also taking Dianabol.
Mm.
So this guy I told you about earlier, Ken Gilbo, who was the first guy to design the exercise program, he was playing on that football team.
Hmm.
So he overheard him telling these guys and thinking, Jesus, that might be a secret. Nobody knew that. This is where a doctor give you a script.
Right, right.
And that stuff worked. So that helped me out. So I never denied that. I looked at it, hey, it was just like protein. If it helps you out, I'm going to try it. I mean, you got to remember, as a kid, I wanted to be big. I wanted to be strong. Hell, I would have ate dog shit if it would have helped me get bigger. You know,
right.
And that's the way most bodybuilders feel. You want to be big. You want to be successful. And I think that holds true of any athlete. You want to be try to get the best at whatever you want, what you want to do.
Yeah. And we did an interview with Bill Grant, and he said that back then the drug usage was much less. The guys would only take it before competition 3 months before the show, and then they would stay off for the rest of the year. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. In other words, when I took the Dianabol, you go back, even John Brewer took Dianabol.
Yeah.
And he was disappointed. Because and the same thing, it made me stronger, but I don't think I ever gained more than 10 pounds. I mean, it wasn't like I gained an enormous amount of weight. But the people today, you know, take all different sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I'm not criticizing, because maybe if all that stuff would have been available, we would have done it too. Who knows?
Right.
Because everybody wants to try and get to the best that they can be. But nobody took very much. I remember talking to Don Horrell, who was another great bodybuilder. I mean, he got in great shape. He was taking, I think it was like 5 or maybe 10 milligrams of Dianabol. I don't think maybe Larry Scott ever took more than 20 milligrams of Dianabol.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the phenomenal shape that he got.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I remember talking to John Brumick. He says, I really didn't care for Dianabol. He says, I got stronger, but he says, I didn't notice that much about it. So after maybe a 6 week period of time, he never took it again, you know.
Hmm. Are you surprised with how big the guys are today, Boyer?
Well, the thing that confuses me is, and it probably is a combination, and I'm not up on everything, but for example, growth hormone, I don't really think growth hormone does that much for you other than metabolize body fat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it really will add a lot of muscle. But I think in combination with that and the steroid, it'll probably work pretty good. But if I've been told that if you take a considerable amount of growth hormone a period of time, it causes everything to grow. So it means the intestines will grow, which causes a lot of guys to have a really thick trunk, thick torso.
Right.
You just, the guys that I admired, as I'm sure I've told you, Sergio Oliva, Steve Reeves, guys like that, the guy to me that one of the all-time best guys that had a V-taper was this guy, Brian Buchanan. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, fantastic V-taper. I really liked him. But they don't seem to have that anymore. I will say this, and I'm not trying to make light of the guys today, it's not at all, but in my day, a guy, a bodybuilder, regardless who it was, could walk out in a silhouette, and just that silhouette, you could recognize, oh, that's Paul Millette,
mm-hmm.
or that's Chris Dickerson, or that's Frank Zane. Today, they all come out, they just kind of look like a bunch of blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. One thing, if I would be critical today about the bodybuilders today, two things I can criticize about. There ain't a damn one of them out there that knows how to pose.
Right.
There's no transition. And the one thing I don't understand, if you're good, the audience is going to let you know you're good. What is this deal about everybody?
Right.
What does that mean? That's ridiculous. I see guys doing that. That's embarrassing. If you're good, the audience is going to let you know. If you're good, they ain't going to say anything. Get your ass off the stage, you know? But why do people do that? That's amazing to me.
What's even worse about Boyer is that's trickling down to the amateur level, and all the amateur shows I see, you see it all the time. Guys are going like this, or they're going like this.
They're going to copy what they see the professionals
right,
do. Another thing I don't read the bodybuilding magazines anymore. Occasionally, when I'm at the market, I'll pass by the magazine rack. What is with, I don't understand, the covers of the magazines anymore. I mean, I can recall fantastic covers.
Yeah.
Took of, like, say, Dave Draper and Larry Scott up in the magnificent photographs. Hell, had a nice smile on her face.
Mm-hmm.
All the guys today on the cover of the magazines look like they're constipated. You know, all this growling and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What is that? Does that make you want to buy the magazine? I don't think so.
I don't know. It's a whole different world now, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Boyer, I think we talked for a couple hours. I want to thank you very much for your interview. I think we could talk a lot more even. He had some great stories, and I appreciate, you know, the great contribution you made to the sport. I always thought you were a classy individual, and you were a great competitor, and I enjoyed watching you in all those Mr. Olympias and reading your stories, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed talking to you. You have a wonderful day.
All right, Blair. You too.
You too.
All right, thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to again thank Boyer Coe for that great interview, and I hope to have Boyer on the podcast again pretty soon because I always enjoy talking to him. And next week, as I mentioned, we will have our interview, finally, with Robbie Robinson, the Black Prince, along with his friend Rick Valente. So best wishes to Robbie if you want to support him. On the GoFundMe page, just go to the Robbie Robinson Medical Support page on GoFundMe.com. And you can make a donation. So hopefully Robbie will feel better soon. And I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Take care.